What I'd like to take a look at today is how Purim became what Purim is. We're all familiar with the Mishnah at the beginning of Masachat Megillah. You see it here at source one, which tells us that we read Megillah on a bunch of different days. But the main thing I want to focus on is the fact that the Purim is a split day. Purim is the only holiday that you have. When you ask somebody, when is Purim? They don't answer with an answer. They answer with a question. And the question is, where do you live? Which makes it, I guess, the archetypical Jewish question. But where do you live? You live in a walled city, non-walled city, etc. And so what I'd like to do is to investigate why Purim is celebrated in a split fashion. Now, this year, it's celebrated in an even odder fashion, which is that it's celebrated on the 14th and on the, I'm going to add something here a little surprising, on the 13th and on the 15th and on the 16th. Because of Purim Mishulash. And then add COVID into the mix, and it's really a lot of fun. Okay.
But and I snow.
Wanted, what? And the snow. And right. I saw the pictures already. So, but the main thing I want to focus on is the 14th and 15th, and I want to start by asking two other questions. One question is, why don't we celebrate Purim on the 13th? That's when the miracle happened. That's when we won. 14th, 15th was when we partied. Why are we celebrating then? And the second question I want to ask is, next year, as we all know, is going to be a Shana Meuberet, otherwise Pesach would end up in December eventually. And when we have two Adars, halachic intuition should dictate that we would celebrate Purim in the first Adar. Because there's a rule, Ein Mavir Nala Mitzvot, you're not allowed to pass a mitzvah by. And Chachamim should have established that when the first Adar comes, you grab it. Besides which, the story happened in the 12th month. And next year, Adar Rishon is the 12th month. And yet, as we all know, the halacha is divsakla, Rishon Gamliel, that we read Megillah in the second Adar. The question is why? So the Gemara gives a reason, but I want to explore that reason a little bit. And the reason given in the Gemara is Mismach Geula Ligula Adifle, that we want to keep Purim as close as possible to Pesach. Now, there's a pragmatic reason for that, which has been suggested, and I think it works. Which is that way for everybody out there, all of the people throughout the lands know that when you get up from your Purim Suda in a regular city, that night, exactly 4 weeks from that night, is Bidikat Chametz. And it makes it easy. And you don't have to start saying Hebrew, Yorba. It's very simple. But I think there's something deeper going on. So let's take a look at starting from here. The Mishnah dictates that we have the walled cities and the unwalled cities. And the walled cities, by the way, from the time of Yehoshua ben Nun, which is the Zav Machloket, maybe it should be from the time of Achashverosh, right? And there's a Machloket Bavli Yerushalmi, why we determine it based on Yehoshua ben Nun. The Bavli says it's because of the word prazi, unwalled cities, which also shows up in Sefer Dvarim. And so therefore, it's like linking it to the time of the entrance to the land. The Talmud Yerushalmi famously says, and the Rambam quotes this, it's because Megillat Esther is the only story that we have in Tanakh that is not connected to Eretz Yisrael at all, except as a place to be exiled from. And this way, it brings kavod to Eretz Yisrael, that it'll kind of remind us, was this a city that was walled at the glorious times of Yehoshua ben Nun? Okay. It also means that many cities in Israel that are currently, at that time, destroyed, will still be reading as if they had walls around them. So it's a whole lot of glory for Eretz Yisrael. By the way, the Ritva, who I don't have here, suggests something really brilliant. He says that the story of Purim is connected meta-historically with the war against Amalek. And the first person to go do battle against Amalek was Yehoshua. So the connection is it's a lot of different weaves and bobs here to connect it with Yehoshua. But the larger question is, why a split celebration? Now, the Gemara asked this question, and it asked this question based on a pasuk that we're going to take a look at later that describes the celebration of the unwalled people on the 14th. And the Gemara here in source 4, and I have the translation, now the question here is not why Yehoshua, which the Gemara already dealt with, but why a split celebration at all? And the Gemara gives its answer and then raises a crazy Havamina, a nutty kind of supposition that is out there. It's not, I'm not the one who calls it nutty. The Gemara calls it nutty. You'll see. Minahani mili. So how do we know that there's a split celebration? Amar Rav Damar Kra, because the Torah says, the Mikra, so Megillah says, Alkena Yudima Prazima Yishvim Barea Prazot. Therefore, the unwalled Jews who live in the unwalled cities celebrate on the 14th. All right, so the Megillah explicitly says people in the unwalled cities celebrate on the 14th. Mid the Prazim Biar Ba'asar. And by the way, it never says in the Megillah that in Shushan, the celebration is on the 15th, is to be on the 15th. And certainly not other walled cities. So where are we getting it from? So the Ross says, Mid the Prazim Biar Ba'asar Mukafin B'chamishasar. Okay. Since the Megillah says that there's 2 days of Purim, 14th and 15th, and it says the unwalled cities celebrate on the 14th, it makes sense that the walled cities are on the 15th. And the Gemara goes through all sorts of other possibilities. Maybe the unwalled cities are on the 14th, and the walled cities are on the 14th and the 15th, or the 14th or the 15th. And then it raises this really weird havamin, this really weird supposition. Ema prazim be'arba'asar mukafin klal klal lo. Maybe people living in unwalled cities celebrate on the 14th, and maybe people living in the walled cities don't celebrate at all. Now, by the way, besides the knockdown the Gemara is going to give, it also doesn't stand the test of the Psukim because it says Purim was established to be celebrated on the 14th and the 15th. But the Gemara says something else. Belav Yisrael Ninu, aren't the people in the walled cities also Jewish? They have to celebrate Purim. Ve'od, now this is Ve'od is a little strange, Mehod Ve'ad Kush Ketiv. It says that the Persian Empire spread from the Indus River into Africa, and all the Jews lived under that, which means there are Jews in walled cities and in unwalled cities, and so they were all under threat, and they were all saved, so they got to celebrate. So there's two different ways of saying the same thing. This is a celebration for all the Jewish people, and therefore everybody's got to have it. The second thing is that the people in the walled cities were also under threat, and therefore they've got to celebrate. Okay, I get it. Now, the Rambam here in Source 5 says exactly what we saw in the Yerushalmi. Why did it mentions the 14th and the 15th? Why associated with Yoshua bin Nun? Because, again, Kavod Eretz Yisrael. And here's that Ritva that I mentioned. Okay. But I'd like to take this a little bit further. What I really want to do is to take a look at how this entire holiday evolved. And to answer the question, the small question, which is why a split celebration, the larger question, which is why two separate days, and the larger question, which is why Adar Sheni. You'll see why I'm scaffolding it that way. And we get to the story of the celebration. So just to give a little context, on the 13th day of Adar, the 13th day of Adar. And I want to talk about the 13th of Adar. As soon as we finish this, I'm going to come back to that. On the 13th day of Adar that year, all HE double matchsticks broke loose in the kingdom. All of the enemies of the Jews had been anticipating that they would kill the Jews, and the Jews now had the rights of the government to defend themselves. And when all the dust had settled, the enemies of the Jews were killed, Haman's sons were executed. They then, the next day, they were hoisted up on a tree to be displayed. Oh, you know, however you feel about it, but it was quite victorious. And then in the summary, we get the following. Now, parenthetically, Esther comes to the king on the 13th. And the king says to her, in Shushan, the Jews killed 500 men plus the 10 sons of Ammon. And they're sort of put into a separate category. And what happened in the rest of the kingdom? And then he says his normal thing, which is, what's your request? Half the kingdom, etc. And Esther says, I have two requests. Request number one is to take the bodies of the carcasses of Haman's sons and hoist them up on a tree. And the second is to give another day for the Jews in Shushan to defend themselves. So those two things are her requests. Okay. And the king allows it. And then the text says, Vaikalu Ayudim, here you have it, and you have it in English underneath. Vaikalu Ayudim Asher B'Shushan Gam B'Yor Ba'asar L'Chodesh Adar V'Yigu B'Shushan Shlosh Miot Ish. So they killed another 300 men. U'Vabizal Lo Shalchu Et Yadam. And they did not take any loot, even though they had the rights to. U'Shar HaYehudim Asher B'Deot HaMelech Nikalu V'Yamod HaNafsham. And now we get the full report. The Jews throughout the kingdom gathered and defended themselves. V'noach mi'oyveihem, v'harog misoneihem, chamisha v'shivim alef. Right? So they had respite from their enemies and they killed 75,000. I'm not sure what to do with that number, if it's literal or it's hyperbolic. V'abizal lo shachu et yadam. They didn't take any loot. Now, v'yom shlosha asar l'chodesh Adar. That was the day of the battle. And now I want to talk about the 13th of Adar. What is the 13th of Adar for us in almost every year, including this year? What is it? What do we do?
Fasting.
Fasting, right? Okay. Why are we fasting on the 13th of Adar? We're going to get to that. But I want to point out that establishing a fast on the 13th of Adar is halachically very problematic, or should have been. So I'll start by asking this. What is the oldest halachic work that we have? Oldest halachic composition that we have? It's older than the Mishnah. Because that
Megillat Tanit?
What? Megillat Tanit. Exactly. Very good. Megillat Tanit, which we have studied in the past, especially in the context of Hanukkah. Megillat Tanit is a halachic composition from the first century that lists days in which there were either Hasmonean military victories or Pharisaic rabbinic victories. And those days or periods are times when we're not allowed to fast. Megillat Tanit, you're not allowed to fast. And in many cases, you're not allowed to have eulogies either. And it's a calendar that starts in Nisan and goes to Adar. And it mentions 35 different dates or periods. The most famous of them, of course, is the 25th of Kislev. It says the 25th of Kislev, there's 8 days of Hanukkah, you're not allowed to fast or have eulogies. Okay, that's all it says. The commentary on it tells all the background, the story, Nespach Hashem, and etc. But Megillat Tanit just says that line. When we get to by the way, there's two dates in Megillat Tanit that you're familiar with. Hanukkah and Purim is mentioned there. When we get to the very end, to Adar, just before Purim, it says the 13th of Adar is Yom Nicanor. Very famous battle in Jerusalem with a Greek general, Nicanor, who was defeated. And that battle took place on the 13th of Adar. You're not allowed to fast. Interesting problem. So what happens is the Gemara in Masechet Rosh Hashanah, before anybody ever heard of a Tanit Esther, because it doesn't show up for a while, says, Batla Megillat Tanit. The rules of Megillat Tanit are canceled. Since the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, we don't commemorate these days anymore. And the only two exceptions are Hanukkah and Purim. So the 13th of Adar got knocked out of its special place. And then sometime in the 8th or 9th century, we find a mention of this custom to fast on that day, which became Tanit Esther. Why are we fasting then? We're going to talk about it. So the description goes, now I'm in the yellow highlight, V'noach be'arba'asar bo. The Jews fought on the 13th and rested on the 14th. And again, one of my questions is, why aren't we celebrating the 13th? That's the day of the victory. Celebrate on the 13th. Va'aso to yom mishtev simcha. What did the Jews do on that day? The day after they beat their enemies. So what do you do after you beat your enemies? You party. They had a party. All right. And this is a party that, Dovi, I'll have to take you back to 2016 in the Chicago Cubs for this. But here in LA, we have much more recent memories of this sort of thing. What happens whenever, it used to happen on an almost yearly basis, the Lakers win the championship. Or every 40 years or so when the Dodgers win the championship. What happens? Immediately, with the last out, or with the buzzer, bedlam in the streets. People pour out in the streets. This year was a disaster because of COVID, but that's what happens. So spontaneous celebration. 3 days later, there's a parade, which is organized. All right, and Sammy Sosa's up there waving his arms, and LeBron is waving. Depends on the parade, depends on the city. But right, big, nice parade. That's organized. Please watch what happens. You'll see the model. The year that it happened, on the 14th, they just went out and partied. What did they make it? A party. That's it. There's nothing else but the party. The people in Shushan celebrated, fought on the 13th and 14th. So they finished their job on the 13th and 14th. They need an extra day to fight. We'll talk about why in a minute. And then on the 15th, they're done. And they made it a party. Now, this is only a record of that year. Meaning, what we're reading now is history. meaning in that year, the Jews fought on the 13th, celebrated on the 14th. The Jews in Shushan fought on the 13th, 14th, celebrated on the 15th. That's it. And now we jump ahead. We jump ahead clearly by at least a few years, because this pasuk reflects an observation being made by somebody who has seen something happen for a few years. And you see it from the verb. Alkena yudim ha-perazim ha-yoshevim be'arei ha-perazot. Therefore, the Jews in the unwalled cities, osim, what does osim mean? This is what they do. It's like a description of a regular custom. Et yom arba'asar l'chodesh adar simcha u'mishteh v'yom tov. Now, by the way, that tells you something. Who created Purim? And the answer is quite straightforward. The people did. It's a grassroots holiday. And what do the people in the unwalled cities do? They celebrate on the 14th, simcha u'mishteh, but now they're able to make it yom tov. Well, whether Yom Tov means Isur Malacha or just a festive day, but that means it's on the calendar now. It's not a spontaneous response. It's more like the parade. It's planned out. And they add one more component, which is Mishloach Manot Ish L'Re'ehu. All right, now what's Mishloach Manot about? So it's actually quite straightforward. The first year, the year it happened, there's Bedlam, and where's the party? The party's in the streets. People bring out barrels of wine. People bring out plates of meat. People bring out all their stuff and big party. Everybody's there, the whole community. What happens the next year? The next year, there's an organized party, right? So there's the B'nai David party, and there's the Beth Jacob party, and there's the Young Israel party, et cetera. And then there's the Ados party. Everybody's got their party. But we don't want to lose the flavor of that original year. So what do? So Young Israel takes a plate from their party, and they send it over to somebody at Beth Jacob. And so that way there's a networking, and Beth Jacob sends one to B'nai David, and they send it around so that everybody has a little bit of everybody else's party. So it's kind of like we're all partying together. That's, by the way, what Mishloach Manot is, sharing the party. So you've networked and you've created a community-wide celebration like it was, but in organized fashion, 30 people in your house, 30 people in my house, 30 people in your house, 50 people in his backyard, but we're all together through Mishloach Manot. Okay. Now who's celebrating here? The unwalled cities. Who's not celebrating? Shushan. Why isn't Shushan celebrating? Very simply, the Ramban makes the suggestion, and the information seems to back it up historically, that the Jews in the Persian Empire, by and large, lived in Jewish towns. The only town they lived in that was cosmopolitan was Shushan, because of the government. So when you live in a Jewish town, that means if you have a wall around you, you're not threatened. And that's, by the way, why the Gemara, this is the Ramban's explanation, why the Gemara suggests that maybe Jews in walled cities won't read Megillah at all. Maybe they weren't really under threat. If you're living in an unwalled city, your threat comes from down the road. So you get out there, you get your arms out there, and you rebuff that threat, and you're done. Shushan is more difficult because it's a walled city and you're living with your enemy in the wall. So you need an extra day. But there's another problem. The year after it happened, I can easily celebrate in Yechupetz because Yechupetz, Anatevka, Persia. It's all Jewish. What's the problem? I'm celebrating. We're all happy. But I can't celebrate in Shushan because I'm going to have a parade and all the people staring at me have a yard site. It's not nice. And it could create a lot of enmity. It could have a lot of problems. So the people in the unwalled cities create a holiday and they celebrate with food and drink. But notice when they celebrate on the 14th. And the people in Shushan aren't celebrating at all. What happens? Mordechai steps in. Now, when Mordechai steps in, he's wearing one of two hats. He's wearing a hat of most important Jew in the world. And he's also wearing a hat of viceroy. I believe that this is written as a viceroy. He sends messages to all the Jews that they have to celebrate the 14th and the 15th every year. And now watch where the 15th comes from. Because Mordechai says, I'm seeing that the Jews out there are celebrating not on the day of the victory, but they've decided to celebrate on the day of the party. And they're very wise to do so, and I'll explain why. So I'm going to extend that and say, since the party in Shushan was on the 15th, you have to celebrate in Shushan on the 15th. And here's the line, Kayamim Ashenachma Meyudim Yoyehem, to celebrate just like the days that the Jews had respite from their enemies. In other words, we're not commemorating a victory. We're recreating an experience. And therefore, we're going to do it exactly like then. If you're in an unwalled city, you celebrate on the 14th. If you're in a walled city, you celebrate on the 15th. Okay, very good. And Mordechai adds something to it. La'asototam yemei mishteh v'simcha, so far so good. Mishloach manot ish l're'ehu. And he adds matanot levyonim, which gives it the full Yom Tov experience. As we see in Sefer Dvarim, you're obligated to include the poor and the widow and the orphan, etc. It's a full experience. But where's this coming from? So the answer is actually quite straightforward. If you are living in, first of all, who created the holiday? You can see it right here. The holiday is called Purim. Why is it called Purim? Purim is not a Jewish word. Purim is a Farsi word. It's not Hebrew. The answer is because it wasn't made up by the rabbis. It was made up by the people. They called it Purim because of the poor, because of the lottery. So what is going on here in this story? It's very straightforward. You're a Jew living in the Persian Empire in the 5th century BCE. There was a threat of genocide hanging over your neck, hanging over your head, and miraculously you were saved. You want to celebrate this on an annual basis. You decided to celebrate it on an annual basis. You live in the unwalled cities. You got no neighbors you got to worry about. How do you celebrate it? So where do you look for inspiration and guidance? It's very simple. You look in the Torah. Is there anywhere in the Torah that there is an event which the Torah says is so powerful you have to celebrate it every year and it's an event of salvation? Is there? Is there anywhere in the Torah that there's an event?
Mitzrayim.
Yeah, Mitzrayim, exactly. Now, how does the Torah tell us to celebrate Yetziat Mitzrayim? And the answer is, it tells us to do two things. Throw out some things that we do.
Food.
What?
Food.
What about food? What food? What food?
Well, you have specific foods on Mitzrayim for Pesach.
Okay, so we have matzah. I'm going to put that in category A. Eat matzah, get rid of chametz, all that stuff. What else?
Well, tell a story.
Good, that's B. Basically, it's two things. Recreate and narrate. That's what we're told to do. And it develops even in the line of the halakha of the Chachamim, of Haseba and Arba Kosot, are all part of recreate. Even the halakha at the beginning of Arvei Pesachim, you're not allowed to eat before the Seder, the Ritva explains beautifully, is because you should come to the table feeling like a slave, hungry, and you're willing to be satisfied with a little cracker. You have to recreate the experience. And that's what we do at Pesach. We play act. We have all sorts of great stuff we do. But it's not enough to recreate. We also have to narrate. The Torah commands us both, Achilat Matzah and Haggadah, Korban Pesach and Haggadah. And we have to narrate in a way that is playful and play acting and interactive and intergenerational. Beautiful. And we're all familiar with that. And by the way, it is the single most successful educational model in the history of mankind, is the Pesach Seder, bar none. So you're a Jew living in the Persian Empire, and you say, okay, I want to take inspiration from Pesach in order to commemorate this miracle. So what do? I recreate the experience. What was the experience? So fundamentally, the experience was one of party. So I'm going to have a party. When? On the same day that they partied. But that's not all that I'm going to do. Ultimately, what develops is recreate and narrate. So I act out all of the events, and I also tell them. But there's something more here. What did the Jews in Persia do on the 13th of Adar that year, if they were not able-bodied and able to fight? What did they do? So simply, they fasted. Matter of fact, the first place we see that is in the story of, which you mentioned earlier, Yehoshua fighting against Amalek. While Yehoshua is fighting against Amalek, where's Moshe Rabbeinu? He's up on top of the mountain with Aharon and Hur. Got his hands up. What do Chazal say from that? Mikan she'ein ta'anit sibur pachot mishlosha. The minimum amount of people you need for Tanit is three. In other words, Moshe Aaron are fasting. Why are they fasting? Because they can't fight. They got another job and they're too old. So Moshe is fasting while they're fighting. What were the Jews in the Persian Empire doing on that day? This is way after the 3 days of fasting. What were they doing on that day while the Jews are fighting? They're fasting. So what do? We fast. What else? We celebrate on the 14th, and the people in the walled city celebrate on the 15th because that's what they were doing. In other words, we recreate that year with split celebrations. I ask you something else. If you are the outfit director, whatever the word is, for the off-Broadway production of Esther, how busy are you going to be with Mordechai offstage? How many times does Mordechai change his clothes? So the wardrobe director. How often does Mordechai change his clothes? A lot. Regular clothes, sackcloth and ashes, regular clothes, royal robes, regular clothes, special royal robes, and then other special royal robes, constantly. And by the way, everybody in the Megillah looks to be one person, there's somebody else. Esther looks like a goy, she's Jewish. Mordechai looks like a goy, he's Jewish. Haman looks like a trusted advisor, he's a traitor. Ahasuerus looks like a king, can't make a decision. In the meantime, who's hiding behind all the curtains in the Megillah? HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Is it any surprise that there's a custom for us to wear costumes on Purim? We're simply acting out the story. Everything that we do around Purim is recreating. So now you can understand, first of all, why we celebrate on the 14th, because we're recreating the celebration. Why we celebrate on the 14th and the 15th, because there was a split celebration that year because of the way people fought. We now understand why we celebrate in Adar Sheni, because we want to celebrate close to Pesach, not just for the convenience of I count 4 weeks and do B'dikat Chametz, but because the celebration of Purim is anchored in Pesach. The whole mode of celebration is taken from Pesach. And Pesach and Purim, while they're at opposite ends of the year, beginning and end, and Chazal say, Pesach is the beginning of Esther, Sof Kol HaNisim, it's the end of all the Nisim. But on the other hand, Purim comes right before Pesach, and Purim leads into Pesach. And Purim, Chazal tell us, is also sort of a harbinger of what the future Gula will be like. So when we take a look at this record in Perek Tet of Esther, it records how the celebration started and then got the imprimatur of the prime minister, Mordechai, to be added into Shushan, you can see how dependent the entire structure is on the Pesach model. And now we understand why Mismach Gula LeGula, why we want to attach the Gula of Purim to the Gula of Pesach. And hopefully everybody, well, next week we're going to do another Purim Shir, so we'll talk more Purim.